Good morning. You're listening to the Peter Eichmann Show. This is Scooter, and we have Peter in the studio. Today we are going to talk about Enron. We're going to talk about some tech-related issues. We're going to have Coach Aikie from WSU Football in the studio with us at 8 o'clock. I'm looking forward to this. Rhino, the sports dude, will be in, and I'm also going to introduce... We have a new sports reporter who's going to deal with WSU athletics as far as volleyball and women's and basketball. We're going to have him look at track and field as well as the cross-country teams. A lot of the sports around here that doesn't get the media attention that it probably should. We're going to change that, and our sports reporter will be introduced next week, but I just want to let you know we do have one coming. Also, at about 8:30, we're going to have an intramural sports update. A reminder that this coming next, actually a week from this Monday, it will be the 25th. We have John Sherman, Transit Director Rod Thornton, as well as a new guest was just booked with them, John Sheehan, who's the Director of Parking Services. They're all going to be in to speak about Pullman Transit and the city budget. And I suppose if you have a parking question or two, you could call in and talk about that. Also coming up in early March, we're going to have Glenn Johnson, the PA voice announcer of the WSU football team and men's basketball. Also, the background song you hear right now is called Cool As You. It's the instrumental version, made by a group called Landis, local from Pullman here. They actually met while they're living in Stevens North Landis House. They are scheduled to come in for an interview, plus I have one other person scheduled, the manager of Student Computing Services, George Ball. You are listening to KZUU FM 90.7 FM. This is Scooter, and we got Peter Mann in the studio.
Morning.
And are you having trouble getting the word out about your club event? Well, KZUU can help. KZUU offers public service announcements free of charge to people just like you who are looking to get the word out. Come and fill out a form available every day outside the Cub, room 311. Thank you. Okay, today, like I said, we are going to be talking about Enron and the issues surrounding Enron. We have a comment that I'd like to read by one of our listeners and viewers of our website. Left a message on there when they found out what we're going to be talking about today, and I'd like to read what his message is, and then we'll turn it over to Peter Mann, who will get us started with this Enron whole deal. The username is Michael, and he's on our discussion board. You can get there by going to wittybanner.com, and there's a link right off the front page to the Peter Eichmann site, or you can go to our website at www.informationtechnologyprofessionals.com/PES, as in the Peter Eichmann Show. And from there, you can link to the web. You can link to our discussion board. You can also read about our show, what we have scheduled for today, all of our resources that we use from the web that you can link up to. And we also have audio clips from our previous shows. We have a couple photos, and soon we are going to have video available via the web, and you will be able to download that as soon as we get our video clip running. Now here's what Michael had to say. Yes, they screwed up big time, they being Enron. Yes, they're crooked, once again, they being Enron. But look, it's our fault that this happened. The stock market is a gamble, okay. And nobody seems willing to say this. Every day I have less and less respect for the major media. And obviously he's not talking about us, because I don't think he considers Pullman, Washington a major media source.
Not yet, anyways.
Because they seem incapable of getting the story straight, whether that's because they report for idiots or they're idiots themselves is beyond my level of understanding. Look, who got hurt here? Who got hurt? We talk about Enron like it's the biggest scandal in the history of scandals, but it's not. A lot of people lost money, including members of my own family. One relative of mine lost his entire 401k. But that's what happens when you play the market. And I emphasize the word play here. That's not being reported. What's being reported is, boo-hoo, Enron is so bad. They lied and they are bad people and they should go to hell or at least maybe jail. Okay, And you know where that gets us. Absolutely nowhere. It sets up for the next Enron, which comes along and wastes our money because we foolishly spent it on the market. It's absolutely asinine. What do you have to say about that, Peterman?
Well, really, he brings up some great points, and I can't really disagree with him for a lot of the aspects on having the people playing there in the stock market. That is entirely their fault. I don't disagree with them there. And as far as respect for the major news media goes, I lost respect for them years ago, so I certainly don't disagree with them there. CNN, ABC, Tom Brokaw, Dan Rather, they have lost all respect as far as I'm concerned. But what's really the key, one of the key issues that the email completely misses and doesn't address at all, is that there is a scandal here. Now, I'm not saying there's a scandal within the Bush administration, because I don't believe that for 1 minute. But Enron did lie about their books. They did report fictitious gains, which elevated their stock prices. And the only reason that Enron was considered one of the largest companies and filing the largest bankruptcy known is because of these fictitious gains. It's not like they were this huge company and then they built themselves up and now all of a sudden they're filing bankruptcy because of bad stock decisions. They lied about their gains. They lied about how large they were through false companies and false holdings. And that's one of the big, major reasons that people are complaining right now. Now, today when we talk about Enron, I'm going to break it into three main parts. There's the Enron scandal as far as the lying goes on the books and how they really weren't as large as they said they were. There's also the idea that the people who lost all their holdings should somehow have not lost them and that their 401k plans, that what their whole retirement plans should be given back to them or something through the government, which I completely disagree with. And then there's the third part, and the third section is this supposed conspiracy that Democrats keep trying to link the Bush administration to the Enron fiasco and its filing bankruptcy. And we're going to discuss all three of those today in that order, if long as time allows. Now, with the first issue, Enron lied about its holdings. One of the things that they did is they would report fictitious gains on transactions with off-book entities. That basically means that they had partnerships and companies that basically gave them illusionary profits, which helped Enron look like it was larger than it really was. What they did is they would get a company, and the only asset that company would have would be shares from Enron. So you have this big holding company, and the only thing that it has in its name is Enron shares. Now, any time that company does business, Enron reports it as a profit. But since it's Enron shares, it's just money going around in a circle. So to report that as a profit is a fictitious gain. I mean, they're outright lying. And that's one of the major areas that is in getting all the FBI investigation. It's not because these people lost all their money. I mean, that may be sad, but that's what the stock market is. It's a risk. But the fact that they lied about their gains, which tricked people, you could say, into wanting to invest in their stock by artificially boosting the prices of their stocks through illusionary gains, people look at it and they say, wow, this company looks really good, when in fact it's failing or it's barely getting by. And so that's one of the major areas of concern. That's why the FBI is investing Enron. That's why the Security and Exchange Commission is investing Enron. That's where a lot of the problems really arise from in the whole Enron debate. And, I mean, with the illusionary profits that the company created and reported for their earnings, in 1999, it reported over $1 billion in earnings that it didn't make. In 2000 and 2001, it also reported over $1 billion. So over 3 years, $3 billion. That didn't exist, that never happened, were reported on their earnings. Now that's enough to make any company look huge. $3 billion. That's a lot of money. Now, with these hedging transactions, is what they're officially called, they were merely issuing shares, calling the issuance earnings. And that clearly violates existing SEC law and the most basic norms of corporate behavior, to quote Mr. Tauzwin of the Washington Times. And he gets it absolutely correct. Enron's disclosure of its gross overstatement of earnings and understatement of debt last fall precipitated the collapse of the company and its stock, causing $60 billion in losses for investors and company employees, and leading to dozens of investigations and lawsuits. That's where we're at right now. Because of their overinflating of their earnings and their illusionary profits, $60 billion in losses. But you have to ask yourself, is that really $60 billion? Or how much of that is part of the illusionary profit? I mean, having the number one bankruptcy of all time seems really bad, but how much of it was real money? I mean, most of it was a lie. That's the whole reason they collapsed. So while people make this out to sound really bad, it's not as bad as it might seem. And that's the basics of how the scandals works together. I mean, really, all these people are saying we need new laws and new regulations to make sure that this never happens again. Well, what exactly happened that isn't already against the law? I mean, why do we need new regulations when they broke existing regulations to do what they were doing? And that's another area that's really important about this investigation. Did they do something legal that turned bad, or was everything that they did illegal, which is why they collapsed? And it is the latter. Everything they did was and is illegal, and it will always be illegal, and there's no need for more laws to further make it illegal. It's already illegal. That's all that needs to be done. And so it's like Mr. Tazwin says, before we rush to impose new laws and regulations in the wake of this scandal, we will want to be sure we are actually enforcing existing law. And that brings us to the second point. All of these people that lost their money in Enron, it's a sad thing. I mean, their entire retirements are gone. I feel for them. That's bad. I mean, having your entire investment, your entire retirement just go up, poof, in one bankruptcy, you've lost everything, is unfortunate. But that's what the stock market's all about. It's taking risks. And like the email at the beginning of the show said by Michael, he got it absolutely correct. It's a risk to be in the market. You know, there's no guarantees, nothing. It's unfortunate, but that's what happens. Now, these people could have helped reduce the risk in many ways, which they didn't. They could have diversified and spread out their investments over several companies. That way, this one big Enron bankruptcy would not have taken everything that they had. And that's the big thing about the stock market. You don't put all your eggs in one basket. You spread it out. By putting it all in one spot, they were almost asking for it to begin with. And that's just plain stupid, period. No matter who you are, if you're investing for a long-term retirement, you do not put it all in one company. Now, there's the people out there who will say, well, they had it all in one spot, but they weren't allowed to trade. They weren't allowed to get rid of it. And they couldn't even trade all their stock if they had wanted to, if they'd been allowed. Well, there's a lot of misconceptions going around here, which I intend to clear up real soon. Now, the way the Enron system worked of buying stocks in the company, people did not have to buy stocks in the company. They could invest their money in any company that they wanted. People chose to invest their money in Enron stocks. They were not forced to. Now, Enron obviously did offer some incentives because, of course, if you're a company, you want your employees to invest in it. You know, circular money. It makes you money and it makes them money. It's the perfect system. The way they did this is for every $2 that an employee contributed towards Enron stock, the company would give them $1 worth of stock. Now, the catch here was that $1 worth of stock that the company gave each employee was not to be sold or traded until the employee was age 50. Now, there's nothing wrong with that here. They're giving you stock under the condition that you keep it until you're 50. That's not criminal. That's very generous of them to give you stock. They don't have to do that, and they choose to. Now, with the $2 worth of stock that the employees invested of their own money, they were allowed to trade that any time they so chose. The only exception was during the freeze that happened while the administrations were switching. Now, I can already hear all the people out there saying, oh, well, they froze that, and that's why there's this huge problem, and no one was able to get rid of it, and boo-hoo-hoo. And, you know, I'm crying. If you could see, I'd be crying.
Democrats piss me off.
But the problem there is that they were warned months in advance, months and months, several months in advance, that that freeze would be taking place. People could have traded their stock long before that froze, before all the stock was frozen. They knew of it in advance. They had forewarning. I don't know how to make this any clearer, that they could have gotten rid of the stock. They chose to keep it. Okay? Now, as far as trends in the stock market go, at one time, over the past 6 months, their stock was as high as $90 a share. And up until the freeze, it had dropped down to around approximately $12 a share. Now, that is a huge drop. And for anybody to keep that stock with a drop like that, seems like they were kind of asking for it also, in my opinion. You know, that's what the stock market's about. If it's dropping that much, you can get rid of it, or you can keep it hoping it will go back up. But it's a risk. And they took the risk, and they got called on it. It happened. The company went bankrupt. It's unfortunate. It's the stock market. Now, for all the people out there who think that we should do something to help these employees because they lost everything and their entire retirement that they were counting on by putting it all in one spot and not getting rid of it when it dropped $78, well, here's something that you can think about. Of all the employees that were keep holding on to it, they were all the former employees had been complaining that the executive should have spread the gloom around the office so that they would have known to dump their shares. So the employees are not complaining that they lost everything. They're complaining that they didn't know they were going to lose everything. What that means is that these employees that you're having all this pity for would have gladly sold you the stock had they known that the company was going to go bankrupt. So they're complaining that no one told them that they should dump their stock. Now, there's some immorality there. I mean, to sit there and complain and say that we owe them something because they lost it all, and then to turn around and say, well, if we'd known ahead of time, they would have sold it to us, seems sort of immoral. I mean, that's like a double standard they're having there. Oh, well, you should feel sorry for us, but had I known, I would have sold it to you so you could be in my position. I mean, are these really the people that we're having sympathy for right now? People that would have stabbed us in the back if they'd known? Because they certainly said that they would have dumped all their stocks, you know. And to quote the National Review, the employees wish that they had known to sell their stocks to some other sucker. They're not angry that Enron was running a scam. They're angry they weren't in on it. Whatever they knew, employees were in a better position to see the company's weakness than outside investors. And that goes back to the whole thing of the money dropping. It's absolutely ridiculous. Now, on to the third point. A lot of Democrats are trying to link the Enron scandal to President Bush and the Bush administration. Now, this is absolutely absurd. I can understand why they're doing it. I mean, President Bush has the highest approval ratings of any president in the history of the United States. And, you know, it's an election year coming for Congress and the Senate. And they want to try and get some representatives. But this is just absolutely ludicrous to think that there was any connection of illegal activity or underhanded buying of politicians between the Bush administration and Enron. Now, first off, yes, the Bush administration met with Enron employees and CEOs of the company, the people in charge. They met with them. Is that a crime? No. No, it's not a crime. It's not a crime to meet with them. Henry Ford met with the president Henry Ford met with the presidential advisors back when Ford Motors was about to go bankrupt. Was that a crime? No. Is it a crime today? No. Is Ford one of the biggest producers out there because they went and got advice from the president? Yes. You know? It's ridiculous to think that meeting with the president constitutes a crime. It doesn't.
Ford's a terrible company, though.
That just makes it all the better. All the better. It's not a crime to meet with the president and talk and discuss issues. It's not. Now, as far as Enron giving money to Republicans, Enron gave money to Democrats and Republicans alike. That's what big companies do. They give money to politicians. Now, yes, Enron gave more money to Republicans than Democrats. Is that a crime? Well, it seems so, because that's probably why this issue is so big right now. Enron gave 75% of it, the money that it donated, or 75% of its contributions, went to Republicans. Now, why would that happen, you say? Why did they give all this money to the Republicans? Could it be that the Republicans won the election and Bush is in office? And so a company that's been giving money to both sides gives more money to the winning party? Could that be a reason why? I think so. It's all about influence nowadays. Everything is about influence nowadays. If politicians would simply put their money where their mouth is and act with integrity...
I'm just curious. Do you know what kind of... how much money Enron gave to the Republicans? And do you have the figures to show what they gave to the Democrats over the last couple of years? I mean...
I might... if I can look through here.
Okay. Well, I was reading a very nice liberal mag yesterday, and I was very disgusted by it. But they actually gave some sort of figure of what they gave the Republicans during the 2000 presidential race. But they made no mention about how much they gave to the Democrats. And I have to believe that Enron gave to the Democrats. I mean, if you don't have the numbers, I was just curious.
I thought I had them here somewhere.
That's right.
Sure I do. I'm looking. I'm still looking. I might have them.
Obviously, his researcher wasn't doing his job properly, eh?
Yeah, it just wasn't outlined like it should have been. I'm going to have to fire that guy. Get someone new. It's always hard to find good help these days. Anyways, while I look for those, I do know that they did give 75% of their money to the Republicans. That I know for sure. Exactly how much they gave, I'm not positive. And I can't seem to find my figures right now.
Well, according to their website I was at this morning at Enron.com, surprisingly it's still actually up and active. I was at the was at a part that was talking about the shareholders and investors and that kind of stuff. And I doubt anybody's going to invest in the company today, but what was really interesting about it is they said the company makes $101 billion last year. I'm like, how can a company with $101 billion made with a $47 or $49 billion assets, how can a company like that go bankrupt without gross incompetence?
Yeah, exactly. And that goes back to the whole idea that they lied about their books. I mean, they gave stocks to false companies, and those false companies then reported the stocks as earnings. And then those earnings went back to Enron because the company was owned by Enron. So Enron was able to report giving of its shares to its own company as earnings. It didn't have $101 billion in earnings of actual money, just in fictitious money. That's one reason. That's the whole reason they went bankrupt. If they'd really been that big, then they certainly would have not had to file bankruptcy. I mean, with their $101 billion of gross and $47 billion of assets, they only had like $25 billion worth of debt, I mean, to pay off. And that's why they had to file bankruptcy. So if they'd made $101 billion, they certainly could have. It was the fact that they lied about making $101 billion that they went bankrupt. But, you know, the other thing that's really interesting about this whole trying to tie the Bush conspiracy, the Bush administration to an Enron conspiracy is, I don't know if for our listeners out there, if you people are familiar with the Carville memo. It's a memo sent out by the Democrats' chief attack snake, to quote Neil Bortz, and he says it perfectly. He is nothing but a snake. Carville is a snake. He sent out this memo, and it told the Democrats in no uncertain terms that they had to find a way to tie Bush and the Republicans to Enron if the Democrats were going to have any chance of making headway in the upcoming elections. And this is a quote from in Carville's own words. The more people hear, the more corrosive it, meaning Enron, becomes. Okay? So the Democrats are definitely trying to tie Bush to Enron for political gains in the elections. Now, what's interesting is that there's a company called Global Crossings. Now, Global Crossings, although I'm sure none of you have heard about it since it never makes the nightly news, except as a brief mention when they're talking about Enron, of course, and how Bush is evil, Global Crossing was a telecommunications company who, on January 28th, filed bankruptcy. Now, they filed the fourth largest bankruptcy in history, and they didn't make the news at all. Never, not once. Well, I can give you a pretty good idea why right here. Global Crossings. All right. Well, I was just told it's time for a break and some music, so when we get back, I'll keep talking about Global Crossings and why you haven't heard about them. Until then, here's some music.
You are listening to KZUU FM 90.7. Mardi Gras Madness at CJ's to benefit the Palouse Regional Crisis Line will be Saturday, March 2nd. Your help is greatly appreciated and will help bring new life to the crisis line. Tickets are fairly affordable, which...
What's that mean? Fairly?
Fairly.
Under $20 or...
I guess. And will be sold at the door. Be sure to show up to that and don't take what we say as the gospel on that. Please call it suicide. We call it murder. Mr. Cliff Baxter, J. Clifford Baxter, committed suicide as a result of this little Enron thing. And according to an article, he was obsessed about the worries of the scandal surrounding the company collapse and would forever tarnish his reputation, and that private investigators were rummaging through his mail and his trash.
Sure he was. Sounds like a conspiracy to me.
Well, Mr. Baxter lived in a $700,000 brick colonial home in an influential area of Houston called Sugar Land with his wife, Carol, and their two kids. He sold $35.2 million of stocks over the last 3 years before he resigned from Enron in May. Mr. Baxter felt his intention to spend more time with his family was going to be frustrated, so he committed suicide so he could spend more time with the family, I guess, right?
Yeah, it seems kind of questionable to me that someone who just got done selling $35 million worth of stocks over the past couple years wouldn't just move to a country that doesn't extradite, you know?
Well, you know, like I said, police call it suicide, we call it murder. I doubt all the cells in his body chose consciously to want to die. I think it was only his brain cells that did that. And then, so, I guess it's more of a murder-suicide.
Yeah, exactly.
I think we both have it right.
I mean,
there.
It was few brain cells to begin with. He committed suicide, so... Classic murder-suicide, just as Scooter over there says. Well, before we went to break, I started talking a little bit about Global Crossing, the telecommunications company who filed the fourth largest bankruptcy ever on January 28th, which happened to be 57 days away from the Enron bankruptcy. Now, why haven't you heard about Global Crossing? Why haven't the news stations been jumping all over that? People lost their entire retirement plans from Global Crossing. Global Crossing had conspiracies, and they're being investigated by the FBI and the Security and Exchange Commissions. Why haven't you heard about that? Well, could it be because Global Crossings is linked to prominent Democratic figures? Okay, here. One prominent investor in Global Crossing was Terry McAuliffe, chairman of the Democratic National Committee.
Could that be McAuliffe, maybe?
McAuliffe?
I don't know. I'm just saying. Maybe it's McAuliffe.
McAuliffe. It could be. I don't know. Yeah, I guess it could be. Maybe the U's silent or something. Who knows? Anyways, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee was a prominent investor in Global Crossing. He got $100,000. He put $100,000 into the investment in the startup of the Global Crossing in 1997, and he turned it into an $18 million fortune when he cashed out in late 90s. So he went from $100,000 to $18 million. Now, Global Crossing had all the same problems and prominent marks that Enron had. It's having the investigations for the exact same crimes that Enron is. And yet the company that has Democratic investors rather than Republican investors hasn't barely even gotten mentioned, terrible, but hasn't even gotten mentioned on the news. I think they've been mentioned a total of 5 times, and that being sentences that ended with Global Crossing when talking about Enron. You know, 5 sentences on nightly news when Enron has been on the front page of every single newspaper across the nation and on every single news station, ABC, NBC, CNN, all your major ones, and how there's this big scandal with Bush and the Republicans and how Enron was total Republican conspiracy and you should just blame the Bush administration for everything that's going wrong here. And yet no one mentions Global Crossings. It baffles me. It goes back to the whole email at the beginning. I have no respect for major media stations. They don't report the news. They report what they want to. I mean, with the Democrats right now, they're able to do something that's called doublethink, you know? And it's a very interesting concept. Doublethink is the concept or the idea of being able to hold 2 opposing ideas in your head and believe them both at the exact same time. Now, on one side of the coin, the Democrats are blaming the Bush administration for being in cahoots with Enron and with their scandalous nature having helped cause this disaster that has robbed people, quote-unquote robbed people, of their retirement funds and their entire plans, and now they're going to have to rely on the Democratic national government. That's the one thought. Now, on the other side, they're blaming Bush for not doing enough to keep Enron from collapsing because all these people lost all of their retirement plans and everything. Now, those seem like 2 opposing thoughts to me. You know, you're blaming him for what happened as far as it collapsing because he was part of it, and then you're blaming him for not being part of it and keeping it from collapsing. It's incredible. Only a liberal Democrat could do that, let me tell you. Dead serious here. Don't know any Republicans that can do doublethink.
That's because Republicans don't think, do they?
Yeah. You know, I heard this great joke once, and it's a classic. You know, there's this Democrat that was jogging down the street by the name of Al Gore, and he was running by with his Secret Service agents, and he ran by this kid who had this box full of kittens. And the kid was, "Democratic kittens, Democratic kittens, come get your Democratic kittens." And Al Gore walked over and he said, "Oh, that's cute. Democratic kittens. That's nice." Well, the next day he came out jogging and he brought Bill Clinton with him. He said, "Come on, Bill, you've got to come see this. This is the cutest thing." And he was running down there and they stopped by the boy with the box full of kittens. And he said, "Come look at these. These are the cutest things." And this time the boy was saying, "Republican kittens, Republican kittens." And Al Gore was like, "Whoa, what happened there? Yesterday you told me these were Democratic kittens. Why the change?" He said, "Well, yesterday their eyes were closed."
If I had a laughter track, I'd be playing it right now.
Of course, I know all you listening are laughing, unless, of course, you're liberals. Then you can call us at
335-2207. That's area code 509-335-2207. Also, you could hit us on our message board at wittybatter.com, or you could go to our website, www.informationtechnologyprofessionals.com/PES.
We'd like all your calls, even if you are wrong. Please feel free to call in. We'd enjoy having a caller on our show. That would be a lot of fun. Back to Bush and Enron. The media seem to be looking for any signs that the collapsed energy giant Enron may have had influence over the Bush administration's energy policy. And yet somehow they're completely ignoring Enron's involvement with environmental activist groups during the Clinton years. They're ignoring the fact that Enron has endorsed policy initiatives that were opposed by the Bush administration, including the Kyoto Treaty, which was the high-profile treaty on climate change that all of Europe seemed to condemn the United States for not signing, even though only 3 European countries actually signed it themselves. That was endorsed by Enron and rejected by the Bush administration. Enron provided almost $1.5 million in grants to green groups that pushed for the Clinton administration global warming policies, all of which the Bush White House has recently rejected. So the whole story hasn't been told here. If Bush was in such cahoots with Enron, how come he's opposed half of the initiatives that they put out there on climate change and treaties and environmental protection and all that stuff? Obviously, he wasn't bought out well enough, was he? If he was bought out at all, which is the point, he wasn't. He never was. It's a Democratic conspiracy. Furthermore, Enron has been a major backer of green groups, groups which have been a thorn in the administration's side since day one. You know, Enron is far from being the champion of Bush environmental policies, even though Democrats refuse to believe it. During the Clinton administration, Enron was a corporate supporter for those who demanded international energy controls to reduce the so-called global warming. And from, or between, 1994 and 1996, the Enron Foundation contributed $990,000, almost $1 million, to the Nature Conservancy. The Conservancy's climate change project promoted global warming theories, which was a key component of the Kyoto Protocol, and one internal Enron memo that was circulated immediately after the 1997 Kyoto meeting showed that the company believed the treaty could provide it with a financial windfall. According to the memo, which was reported first in the Washington Post, the Kyoto Treaty would do more to promote Enron's business than will almost any other regulatory initiative outside of restructuring the energy and natural gas industries in Europe and the United States. Now, that's a long, big, important statement, so I'm going to reread it there. According to an Enron memo that was circulated internally, the Kyoto Treaty would do more to promote Enron's business than will almost any other regulatory initiative outside of restructuring the energy and natural gas industries in both Europe and the United States. So Enron was counting on the Kyoto Treaty for its financial money to get it out of this problem. And Bush was against the Kyoto Treaty. So explain to me how there's a scandal where a president was bought out, supposedly, and yet the president has rejected all the proposals that supposedly would have helped Enron. I mean, it's ludicrous to think that Bush has anything to do with this. The only scandal in this entire Enron fiasco is twofold. One, Enron lied about its earnings and made up earnings through false companies and giving out shares, which overinflated their stock prices and made them seem larger and more profitable than they really were. That was their first problem, error, illegal activity, translates into scandal. The second one is the Democrats trying to link Bush to Enron. That in itself is a scandal. They're doing it purely to gain election, to gain electoral grounds in the upcoming elections, to make Bush look bad. Why are they doing this? Or why are they doing it more so than normal, you ask? Because Bush has the highest approval rating in the history of approval ratings, as far as the president is concerned. You know, with the big war on terrorism and everyone being very pleased with how President Bush is handling everything and the whole situation, the Democrats have no choice but to try and do something to make Bush look bad if they want to get their seats back in the House and the Senate. And they don't want the Republicans to get majority, so what are they doing? Good old Carville, the snake that he is, quote-unquote Neil Bortz, is trying to tie Bush to any negative thing that they can, and right now Enron is the thing in the news. And if you need more proof than Enron, look at Global Crossing. If you need more proof than Global Crossing, look to the fact that the only conspiracy that's even been factually reported is the fact that they overinflated their stock prices through illegal earnings reports. And if you need more proof than that, you're probably a liberal, and I'll never be able to convince you, unfortunately. And that has a pretty much sums up the entire Enron fiasco with the three prominent sections. You got the problem with overinflating their stock prices, the idea that people invested in the company and their investment went bad, which is called the stock market and capitalism, and the idea that the Democrats are trying to link Bush to the Enron scandal when there is none.
Well, what about the fact that Enron is from Houston, Bush is from Texas, and they're probably former bed buddies or whatever.
What about it? Of course Enron gave money to him. But if Bush was so in favor...
Enron is in Bush's old stomping grounds. Wouldn't Enron love Bush? And then Bush probably did some favors, looked the other direction, and said, hey, you know, Enron, you're from Texas. I'm from Texas. Gotta love Texas. Therefore, we're not going to do anything to you guys to punish you for breaking the law.
If Bush was in cahoots with Enron, then how come he denied every single treaty or law that would have helped Enron?
Well, did Bush lose any money in Enron stock?
He lost all of his campaign contribution that would have been coming next year.
Did he lose any personal money in Enron?
Not those.
Oh, he didn't lose any money. So nope. He must have known ahead of time about this collapse, and he was one of the many that sold off his stocks, right?
Did he have stocks in Enron?
I don't know. I'm just assuming.
No. No, he didn't.
Oh, okay. That's because he probably knew ahead of time not to buy it. Once again, he's in cahoots.
Yep. If he doesn't buy them, he's in cahoots. If he bought them and sold them, he's in cahoots. If he bought them and kept them, he's still in cahoots.
No, then he would have been proven innocent. But by the fact that the first two situations are true, at least one of the two are probably true, that would prove that he was in cahoots with them, because he knew, because he was in cahoots with them, that they're like, you know, our stock's trading at $90. I can't believe the fools out there on the trade. They're all going to get burnt here. You might not want to buy any soon-to-be President Bush.
No, not quite. Because if he'd really been in cahoots, he could have bought some at the $90 price, and then he could have sold them right before they...
No, that wouldn't work, though. I mean, we saw that with Hillary. Remember, she's the genius when it comes to cows?
Yeah, and if you'll notice, she still has all that money. She donated some of it to charity, but she still has a lot of it.
Yeah, and everybody knew that she wasn't a cow. Well, maybe she is a cow expert.
You're saying she's a cow? I'm not going to argue with you, but I mean, are you trying to say something about Hillary here?
No, I'm just letting you know that Hillary Clinton played the futures market with, I believe, cattle or beef or whatever, and she seemed to have done something that no known expert has ever been able to do.
That's interesting.
And
she got away with it. So,
well, I think the thing is that she got away with it because she's a what?
Woman? Democrat?
Exactly.
Liberal?
Do you think
lawyer?
Yeah. Do you think Bush would have got away with it? He's getting drugged through the dirt as it is.
Exactly. And that's why he had nothing to do with it.
Oh, I see how it is.
Exactly.
Okay.
Bush had absolutely nothing to do with this.
Okay,
there's more evidence linking Global Crossing to Enron than there is Bush to Enron.
Now, weren't both of those energy companies?
No. Global Crossing was a telecommunication company who happened to be audited.
Do you realize that Enron also did broadband, which would be communication, so I could see the link between the two.
But there's also the link that they both had the same financial auditor who did their books.
What, Anderson Consulting?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that to me is not a big deal, since Anderson Consulting is a humongous firm that does consulting for tons and tons of people.
Yes, and they both did the consulting on the books that were overinflated for false companies that reported false earnings. And they were the financial people who put all
now,
that out.
What evidence do you have that it was overinflated?
That it was overinflated. There was a company, several companies that Enron had in possession of theirs that they had purchased. And those companies' only asset besides the building that they were in was Enron stock. Now, what Enron did was they took this stock and they gave it to these companies, and they reported that as an earning. And they were able to do that because when they were giving away their stock, it was on paper to a company. And that is like, well, when you give away stock to companies, they're paying you, so that's money you're getting. And then, here it is. When the value of to quote the Washington Times, when the value of partnerships assets was actually declining... Wait, wrong sentence, sorry. Enron reported on transactions with two off-book entities, LJM2 and Raptor, when the value of the partnership's assets was actually declining. The company essentially manufactured illusionary profits that inflated the company's reported earnings by over $1 billion in 1999, 2000, and 2001. In the complicated Raptor transactions, which purportedly were designed to hedge risky investments, Enron was doing business with an entity whose only asset was Enron shares that Enron had contributed. Enron was merely issuing shares and calling the issuance earnings, which clearly violates existing laws and the most basic norms of corporate behavior. That violates SEC laws to give your shares to a company that you own and call it earnings. That's a lie, because it's not earnings because you own both companies. You're just transferring shares. There's no money involved.
So that's how they were overinflated?
Yes, because when they gave their stock to this company, there was no money changing hands since they owned both companies. So the stock was just going from one person's name to another person's name, except both people were owned by the same guy. So what happened is, when they gave the stocks away, they said, okay, you know, if they gave away $1 million in stocks, they'd say, okay, we just made $1 million. Well, now that $1 million goes into their earnings, which makes them $1 million richer, even though they're not, and that makes their stock prices go up. That makes their shares worth more, brings in more investors, makes their company look like it's making more profit than it really is, and it's also highly illegal.
Okay. I think on that note, we'll go ahead and go to another break. When we come back from the break, we will be talking about some technical-related issues. Once again, we have Rhino the Sports Dude coming in to talk about sports. And 8 o'clock, Rob Akey.
Oh, yeah.
We're looking forward to that. We've been looking forward to that since football season. Even before we even had our show, we were looking forward to this interview.
If you do nothing else all year, all you listeners out there, be sure to call a friend and tell them to turn in to KZUU 90.7 FM at 8 o'clock or earlier, if you so choose, to hear Coach Rob Akey. Because that'll be a highlight of the show for sure.
For sure. KZUU is still accepting applications for the spring semester. If you are interested in DJing, come pick up an application in Cub Room 311 or online at kzuu.org. Be sure to turn it in. The sooner you apply, the better the chances of you getting a show. Show on KZUU 90.7 FM. This is Scooter, and Peter Mann's in the studio.
Hey.
Remember, you can always call us at area code 509-335-2207. You can reach us on the web at www.informationtechnologyprofessionals.com/EES, as in the Peter Eichmann Show. We also have a message board located at wittybanter.com. And if you don't want to talk about our show, it's always a great site to go to and talk about other issues. It's run by a Seattle guy named Mike Stevens.
Michael Stevens.
And he's been kind enough to offer his services free of charge for the message board for us. And we definitely appreciate the kindness that he has shown us, even though he is soon to be a Husky.
Yeah, that's the only downside. But don't let that stop you from going to his board and talking about anything you want, whether we talked about it on the show or not. I mean, if you talk about something that we find interesting or that you just really want us to have on the show, hey, we'll talk about it on the show, as long as it's appropriate.
Also, you can email us. Our email is located off the website. You can find that both on the bio page and the contact us links and all sorts of other locations. So it's real easy to get a hold of us.
And if you're a liberal, you can go to my site, which is located at www.wsu.edu/PRE, but only if you're a liberal.
Actually, if you're conservative, I'm sure he wouldn't mind you going to the site, but you'll only be educated in things you already know or you already should innately know.
That's about it.
Okay. What we're going to talk about right now is we have a whole bunch of little articles that we've found on the web about technology and technology-related issues. We're going to give you a quick rundown of what they are and a little bit about the issue. And we'll give our commentary, of course. Otherwise, you want to read more about these articles, go to our website, www.informationtechnologyprofessionals.com/PES. And there is a link to each one of these articles. I'll give you the name of the article before I actually read the article itself. First one is called Digital ID, You Shop, They Snoop. Sun Microsystems has joined a group called Auto ID to build a wireless digital identification tags into everything from razor blades to soup cans. The technology promises efficiency for manufacturers and convenience for shoppers, but potentially also headaches for those concerned about privacy. You put your stuff into a grocery basket and just drive by a detector. The detector reads what's in the basket, charges the person's credit card, and tells the factory to restock the shelves. Building a transporter into every such product could spark privacy concerns, says David Holtzman, an internet security research firm researcher and former Network Solutions Chief Technology Officer. People might not be comfortable walking around with items that identify themselves as medications, as condoms, as pornography. They might also not be comfortable with manufacturers tracking where products go after they're purchased. And to quote Mr. Holtzman, if legislatures mandate mandatory tagging of things like firearms or ammunition, we could get both the left and the right wing pissed off.
Now, doesn't this seem like another conspiracy theory to you there? I mean, wouldn't it be nice to have all your items in a shopping cart, and rather than have to wait in a line that's 30 people long with the slowest clerk known to mankind, who just learned to count, who can't hit his keys properly, who doesn't realize that there's a cash register and is trying to add it in his head, while some old lady writes out a check that should have been filled out before she ever got there, as she fumbles around for a pen, and you're just sitting there thinking, oh my gosh, will this ever end? If you could just walk through a little scanner with your cart, and as you're walking through, it automatically bills you, and you can go to your car. No lines, no hassle, no problems. What's wrong with that, man?
Other than the fact that that's a good question, and actually this is covered in the very next paragraph here. Any one piece of information, such as cell phone records, purchasing records, i.e. the razor blades, the soup cans, whatever else you might buy, or a car Lowe's, or a car's specific location, such as through a GPS system or whatever, is in itself not damning or intrusive. But you put everything together, and then you got somebody's whole life. It's very hard to hide things when you have that level of analysis. That's why so many people are against this kind of thing. Like we talked about last week with the national ID cards. That is a very scary prospect, something that we all are going to have to deal with. And once again, we will talk about the national ID card in a future show, talk about the residence hall and what they're doing with the student ID cards and sliding them and everything.
Definitely.
Like that.
Definitely.
I mean, think about it. From the moment you go to bed to the moment you wake up, somebody has the possibility of tracking the fact that you have gone to wherever you've gone. They have the ability to track that you went to a grocery store. They have the ability to track that you bought hygiene products.
This isn't a national ID card. This isn't an ID card. So someone knows what you bought. I mean, the checkout clerk knows what you bought anyways.
Yeah, the checkout clerk is not part of some big database that anybody can read, though.
I mean, they scan all the items that leave anyways, and they link it up to a number, and that number goes to receipt. And if you pay with your credit card, then that receipt is linked to your credit card. And it's a paper trail. It goes back to your items anyways, except right now, even when you play with credit, you still have to wait in line for the lady who writes out a check and there's 30 people in front of you.
Well, the thing about a credit card, though, is when you pay with a credit card, the credit card doesn't necessarily have an itemized listing of what you bought. Like when I go to into a restaurant and buy, you know, a steak dinner and buy something for my significant other, I'm not getting an itemized description of what happened. All I'm getting is the end output and how much I gave for a tip, if I gave a tip.
But with a credit card, you know, when you buy something, it says where you bought it, the date you bought it, and then there's a little transaction number. And that transaction number links it to the store,
Right.
And then that store has that transaction number next to the transaction number that you would find on your receipt. And that receipt's transaction number links it up to all the items that you purchased that went beep.
Right.
Beep,
however,
beep.
If you notice, you've got to go through a couple steps just to find that out, right?
Two, yes.
Two, at least.
Yeah.
And what's to say that the store, depending on the kind of system it has, is going to be able to figure that out? Go down to one of the local restaurants here. Very few of them have some sort of electronic ordering system. It's all done paper and pencil.
How many restaurants are you going to walk through with the steak in your hand so that it can go, oh, well, we're going to charge him for that. As you, do you get steaks to go? I mean, when I go to a restaurant to steak, I eat it in the restaurant, and then I pay afterwards.
Well, that's not the point, and you totally missed what I just said, obviously. I said...
You were talking about restaurants.
And I said that if you go to a restaurant around here, they don't have an electronic system. They have a paper-based system, which means that they're not going to be able to easily or simply go back and figure out what you had.
I'm saying even if Sun Microsystems puts in their system of ID tags, you're still not going to have that problem at restaurants. You're not going to pick up an item and walk out at a restaurant so that the ID tag has any chance to be scanned and registered. At a restaurant,
right,
you're going to order
your
food.
If you notice also, I had gone off on a small tangent, which you have then tried to circle around into some weird, twisted, liberal thing that
I've just
don't
amplified
understand.
Your tangent, but...
You've not amplified it. You've twisted it like a liberal.
I haven't twisted anything.
Anyway, even if these uses aren't what retailers and manufacturers had in mind, the technology has a way of creeping into other domains, Holtz added. Transponders for driving through electronic toll booths started as a convenience to drivers, but are now being used in combination with timing analysis to send out speeding tickets, for example.
Now, see, that's an excellent example. I have to agree with that. That part of it I have to agree with. I mean, excellent example. It shows that it illustrates an excellent point that not all slippery slopes are invalid or conspiracy theories. It actually happens. And that is an excellent point.
Well, I'm appreciative that you like that excellent point
yes.
that I brought up from the article.
Oh, wow.
Okay, and once again, you can get to any of these articles by going to our website, www.informationtechnologyprofessionals.com/PES is in the Peter Eichmann Show.
And here I thought you'd come up with that all by yourself.
That's why I use that little Holtz said thing there. Okay. MPEG, you know what? I was listening to some of our previous shows. And, you know, I mean, we're not being paid a lot of money like some big Rush Limbaugh.
As in,
lady.
We're paying money?
Actually, yeah, that's right. We're not getting paid any money. We get up at 5 o'clock in the morning just because we love doing this. And we're hoping as time goes on, we get better and better. But one thing that I have noticed that I have a bad habit of doing, and I'm working my rear end off to change, is my little say of okay. I'm always saying, okay. Like, that's like my little transition, my powerful transition, okay, and that goes on from every question, okay, so, and it's, I'm sorry, I'm working on this, and if it irritates you as much as I know it irritates one of our listeners who has brought this up to me, I am working on it, okay.
Okay, great.
All right.
Sounds good. So, how are we going?
Good. Okay.
So...
MPEG-4 plan shakes the video industry. A newly proposed MPEG-4 licensing plan is sending jitters through multimedia circles, raising cost concerns about a new standard that promises to bring powerful interactive features to digital video. MPEG-4 is the successor of MPEG-1 and MPEG-2 technologies. MPEG-1 is used on CDs. MPEG-2 is used on DVDs. And behind the MP3 explosion, which obviously most of you have heard in the news at one point in time about Napster and the MP3 sharing thing and whatnot.
How could you miss it?
Yeah. Those are all predecessors of this MPEG-4 compression of audio and video technologies to condense large digital files into smaller ones that can be easily transferred via the web. Under the plan, licensees would pay 25 cents for each MPEG-4 product, such as decoders and encoders, with fees capped at $1 million a year for each licensee. It also suggests charging a per-minute rate with no cap.
That seems a little ridiculous to me.
Yeah, I mean, MPEG, I believe, stands for Motion Picture Experts Group.
Okay.
And it's not... I mean, maybe it is a company, but it just it's really interesting that they want to charge this money. Further information, the article talks about how people believe that with this, if they want this to be the standard, making those kinds of charges is going to really hurt the ability for that to be a standard. Right now, you have Microsoft's media player, you have Real Audios or Real
Real One is what they call it now.
Yeah, they're Real Media format, which, by the way, I do not like at all.
Yeah.
And there's also Apple's QuickTime.
Which, and that's actually a good system.
That is a good system. I don't know what their compression is compared to a media player or anything.
I don't either. I don't use it that much, but when I do use it, it's really good.
But it's sort of disappointing that they want to do this, because I mean, right now you have sort of three different standards out there, and in order to be able to play them, in some situations you have to have two to three different players.
Yeah. And each player you've named, I have. Because I have to.
Right. In order to be able to do anything on the internet with any kind of video.
You know, it's their prerogative. If they want to do that, then that's capitalism. And I'm not going to say that don't do it. But if they want it to remain a standard, since there are other free ones out there still, there will remain three major ones that will still be free. They're going to lose a lot of business. And if they are a company, I don't know what they've been doing for profit so far, but it'll certainly get worse because people aren't going to pay that. I mean, there's three free ones out there that are equally good or really close. And to not charge people is why they're using it. If they start charging people, people will stop using it. Simple as that. Supply and demand.
Yeah.
Economics.
You know, I mean, when you have two different standards, sometimes that definitely can cause problems and difficulties and whatnot. Microsoft says we're issuing a patch for the MSN hole.
Another Microsoft patch. Oh, I'm excited.
Okay. This one I would have to agree with Microsoft and their final statement, which I'll get to in a moment. But Microsoft is putting the final touches on a patch to limit an MSN Messenger feature that allowed any website to grab visitors' intramural. Every time I say IM, I think intramural. But a visitor's instant message nickname and buddy list. The issue occurs because Microsoft designed MS Messenger to allow JavaScript contained in web pages to access a customer's buddy list and, for certain Microsoft sites, the email address of the person. Security engineer Richard Burton highlighted the privacy implication of the feature in a post to Security Focus's Bug Track mailing list recently. It appears to have been intended as a feature so they could put nice customizations on their website. But the UK-based programmer on Friday, I only raised this as a potential, so I don't think people need to panic. Essentially, this guy saw a possibility of a security issue, of not a security, but a privacy issue. And that's what it is.
Yeah.
It's simply a privacy issue. He saw this as possibly being a privacy issue, and he felt that he should do something to fix it.
Well, that's interesting. Doesn't every time you visit a website, can't the site find out stuff about you, though?
Well, I mean,
you're not secure on the internet.
You can find out your IP address and all that kind of stuff. However, your email address is something that people try to keep sort of private within themselves due to all the spammers out there, which to spam we say boo.
Yeah,
and,
definitely.
We, you know, on our website, we've actually taken some measures to protect our email addresses.
Yes.
And we're doing that because we don't want spammers. And just like that, somebody on their personal computer doesn't want somebody coming on there and taking their email address to use in
the case
of a spam.
So, wholeheartedly.
Okay.
I absolutely agree with that.
Microsoft has this to say. The current problem is considered more of a privacy hiccup than a major problem.
Yeah, typical Microsoft. Downplay everything. Put out a new patch.
Well, I don't think this is a downplay. It's very simple. It's a good point brought up by somebody, and Microsoft's like, okay, yeah, that's a good point. We'll go ahead and fix this issue if somebody does indeed have an issue with it.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good.
U.S. officials knock EU's tax proposal. EU would be the European Union.
Ooh.
I think that's almost like the United Nations in our view, right? We don't like the United
Nations.
No.
United Nations is like a million times worse, but the EU is still bad.
Okay. In a statement released by the Treasury Department, Deputy Treasurer Secretary Kenneth Dam warned that the proposal could unfairly discriminate against U.S. companies and cautioned the European Union against approving the proposal for a global consensus emerging on the issue. The European Union requires digital goods to be taxed at the point where they are supplied. For example, a EU company that sells an MP3 file or an ebook to a U.S.-based customer is required to collect tax to collect the EU's value-added tax, also known as a VAT or a VAT. Meanwhile, a U.S. company that sells a similar digital good to an EU resident does not have to collect that tax. Under the new proposal, digital goods would be taxed at the point of consumption, at least in cross-border sales. In other words, sales going from the U.S. to the European Union. EU companies would no longer be required to collect VAT taxes on digital VAT taxes. Is essentially, they're saying value-added taxes.
Yeah.
Taxes. Okay. There I go again.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say that word. That's out of my vocabulary.
Okay.
Shut up.
Okay.
EU companies will no longer be required to collect VAT taxes on digital goods sold outside the Union, while the EU would require companies based in the United States and other foreign countries to collect the VAT on digital goods sold into the EU. U.S. companies and industry insiders already raised numerous objections to the proposal, noting that the definition of digital goods is fairly vague in the proposal and the warning that small businesses may have a tough time complying with it. Well, I could definitely see that. If I am Podunk Pullman, Washington, selling things via the web that I'm not expecting. I mean, yeah, I could probably sell overseas. I guess if I were in the situation where I would be selling overseas, I would definitely need to make sure. I mean, okay, let me start over. Essentially, they're saying
that you do that.
They're saying that if a company in the United States sells something to the EU, the foreign company needs to collect this VAT tax. First off, how do I know what the VAT tax is? Does the VAT tax vary from company or from country to country? And after I've collected this VAT tax, who do I send it to?
Good question. The European Union, of course.
And I guess that's why it's going to be an issue for small businesses.
You know, I've always thought we should just get even. If the European Union wants to do that, we should try to do as little business with them as possible. Although in today's economic situation with the global economy, which is emerging, that's not very likely. We should maybe impose our own tax on strictly European goods. How's that sound? Let's get even.
Sounds like a plan to me. Maybe we should do something like that. Computer sciences gender gap. You don't need Yes, this one's a little bit on the liberal side, but I thought it would be fun to bring up.
Computer sciences gender gap.
It's
the tall white males. It is all their fault. I can tell you already.
He only says tall white male because he is a tall white male. You only need to be a tall white male to be in the computer sciences, right?
Absolutely. And it's tall white males that are discriminating and keeping everyone else out, of course.
Even us short white males?
No.
No? Okay.
No.
Okay. You don't need to visit too many high-tech cube farms and computer programming confabs before you notice women in computer sciences are few and far between. In a new book entitled Unlocking the Clubhouse, Women in Computing, social scientist and scholar Jane Margolis and computer scientist and educator Alan Fisher explore why only a small fraction of high school and university computer science students are female, even though women make up a growing portion of the computer and internet users. A question asked in an interview of Ms. Jane Margolis, is there any evidence of bias against women computer programmers? That sounds like
Of course there is. Sure there is, according to her.
That's a simple yes or no question. And if you read the first part of her question, The answer is no. However,
resounding no.
However, she twists and contorts it, and by the very end of it, she's able to say the word prejudice, which then the rest of everything that she said then goes away in your mind.
Of course.
And you say, oh, there's prejudice there, therefore, yes.
And guess who the prejudice is coming from, who it's stemming from? Tall, white males?
Actually, you'll
Maybe
be surprised.
Maybe short white males.
No, you'll be surprised. Okay.
Okay. Okay. Keep going.
Well, I think, this is her speaking now, well, I think the expectations from parents, teachers, and students themselves in a computer scientist is that a computer scientist looks a certain way. So there's a certain look
to a computer scientist. Mm-hmm.
Okay, what would you think the look is, Peterman?
Oh, it would be the, of course, tall, white male with glasses and probably lanky and wearing two-day-old clothes while he has bloodshot eyes staring at the computer screen. And he probably has a pinup next to his station of some sort.
Some sort of Apple computer pinup so he could throw darts at it, right?
Yeah. Okay. Something like that.
When we ask students, can you describe your fellow students to us, talking about computer science students, they say computer students all work on the computer 24/7. They live and breathe it. They only emerge with a monitor tan. They just love it to their bones, and they want to do nothing else. That image is the expectation of what you need to be a computer scientist. More men than we expected said, that's not me, but did not feel as distressed about the expectation as women.
Oh, my goodness. So they take a gender-neutral description and say that it's biased somehow.
It's biased because, see, men don't care what people think about them.
Oh, that's what it is.
Yeah.
So the gender-neutral, let me stress that, gender-neutral description that was just read is biased because men don't care and women do.
Yeah, they still thought they could fit and that they could pass, whereas women felt very much outside that image and felt more distressed about it because they were more resistant to living their life like that.
Oh, and so they want to become computer science majors. Why? If they don't want to live their life like that?
No, see, that's the point. That's why women don't want to be computer science majors, because of that kind of image. And that is why the expectations and norms are a form of prejudice.
Oh.
Therefore, going back to the original question.
So the actual job description of what you end up doing, which is staring at a computer 24/7, I mean, that's what you do, is prejudice because...
Well, it's simply, is there evidence of bias against women and computer programmers? And the first two sentences say no. However, the third sentence says, well, when you take that real neat contorted thing that I spent a couple minutes discussing, the expectations and norms form a prejudice. Therefore, the last word you hear is prejudice, and we've all been conditioned to think when we hear the word prejudice that there very much so is discrimination, bias, and everything else going on. Parents will always be looking for a certain type of interest, which is based on a male type attachment to the computer. And teachers in K-12 will be looking for that and could overlook a girl who could be very interested and very talented but does not have that persona. Another question in the interview, what is your next project? What issues remain unexplored about gender and race in the field of computer science? I am now looking at the issue of race and gender and at the computer science pipeline in the high school level. So we are focusing, on why so few African American and Latino male and female students are studying computer science in high school. And that's a study yet to be done.
Wow. Sounds like a big waste of money.
Anyway, that will be it for our computer updates. We are going to go to music, and we will come back in a little while with sports.
Sounds great.
You're listening to KZUU FM 90.7.
WSU Lacrosse is holding open practices for beginning and experienced players. Practices will be held Monday at 5:30 in the Fieldhouse, Tuesday 10 to midnight in the Fieldhouse, and Wednesday 7 to 9 at Rogers Field, and Thursday 10 to midnight in the Fieldhouse. The first game is in 3 weeks. Call Greg with questions at 332-3296. Once again, that's 332-3296.
This story is from January 25th of 2002, so it's about 2 weeks old. But head coach Mike Price will be on hand for Monday's event. This is, once again, obviously long past. Head coach Mike Price will be on hand when the Washington State House of Representatives passes resolution number 2002-4687 to honor the Washington State football team Monday in Olympia. The legislation will be passed in the South Gallery of the Capitol Building, and WSU alumnus and current Washington State Secretary Sam Reed will join Price for the ceremony at 10 a.m. Cougar alumni and the public are welcome to attend the event, which will be followed by a luncheon at Athens Restaurant in Olympia. The resolution is designed to honor the 2001 Cougar football team, which was picked to finish dead last in the Pac-10, but instead racked up a 10-2 record and defeated Purdue in the Sun Bowl on December 31st.
Oh, yeah.
And I do have a copy of that resolution. I'll read real fast. It's House Resolution Number 2002-4687 by representatives, and it lists off several of them. I have the list of names if you are interested in finding out who specifically did sign on to this bill. Whereas the Washington State University's Cougars football team, under the leadership of Coach Mike Price, finished the 2001 season with a 10-2 record. And whereas the Cougars were nationally ranked 10th in the final Associated Press poll and 11th in the ESPN USA Today final poll. And whereas WSU has more players named to the Pac-10 All-Academic first and second teams than any other team in the conference. And whereas Mike Price was named 2001 Pac-10 Coach of the Year. And whereas the Cougar defeated the Purdue Boilermakers 33-27 in the 2001 Sun Bowl in El Paso, Texas. And whereas defensive back Lamont Thompson was selected as the Associated Press All-American first team and was a semifinalist for the Jim Thorpe Defensive Back of the Year Award and the Sun Bowl's Most Valuable Player. And whereas place kicker Drew Dunning was named to the Super Bowl Special Teams Player of the Game. And whereas quarterback Jason Gesser was a semifinalist for the Davey O'Brien Quarterback of the Year Award, and wide receiver Nakoa McElrath was a semifinalist for the Fred Blinkinghoff's Wide Receiver of the Year Award. Whereas WSU players Billy Newman, Jeremy Thirlbar, Julie Hollenbeck, Tupo Tupo, James Price, Rennell Smith, Alan Cox, Lamont Thompson, and Nicole McElrath were selected to participate in postseason All-Star games. And whereas Coach Mike Price won the Eddie Robinson National Coach of the Year Award in 1997, was one of three finalists for the award in 2001. And whereas WSU is one of only three Pac-10 universities to have two 10-win seasons in the past 5 years, whereas Coach Mike Price, WSU coach since 1989 and dean of Pac-10 coaches, requires his players to be team members, students, and community leaders. Whereas only five Division I-A and C-2-A coaches in the nation have been in the respective schools longer than Mike Price. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Washington State House of Representatives honor the 2001 Washington State University's Cougar football team for the outstanding season, and be it further resolved that the Washington State House of Representatives congratulates WSU coach Mike Price for his many coaching successes and his excellent leadership he provides to WSU student-athletes. And be it further resolved, the copies of this resolution be transmitted to WSU Coach Price, WSU President Lane Rollins, WSU Athletic Director Jim Stirk, and the captains of the 2001 Cougar football team.
And take that, you Huskies, you worthless dogs.
Yes, the Cougars had an awesome season. And speaking of the Cougars, Coach Rob Akey will be in the studio with us
at the top of the hour.
At the top of the hour. And once again, like I said, we are very excited about this interview coming up. In the meantime, we said that we were done discussing technology issues.
Well, we lied.
The Peter Man saw this one that we just had to discuss this week rather than hold off on it. So I think we'll go through one or two more, maybe three, and go into a few more songs into the top of the hour waiting for Coach Akey. just to have your pencils ready and be prepared for the phone number. Our phone number is 509-335-2207. Be sure to write that number down, and you can have your questions of Coach Ahe answered while he's here in the studio.
Absolutely. Feel free to call us anytime, night or day, whenever, in the next hour, for Coach Ahe. Bring on the questions. It's area code 509-335-2207. Please call and have your questions ready.
British Telecom Prep's defense of web serving patent. British Telecom, BT, will present its case in court next week, claiming it holds a patent on hyperlink technology and has a right to demand a licensing fee. This is not a joke, ladies and gentlemen. This is real news article.
Now you understand why I said we had to talk about it. This sounds like an April Fool's joke.
You can link to this from our website if we don't get sued for a license patent violation thing. You can go to www.informationtechnologyprofessionals.com/PES, and there is a link there from today's current show. And if you are curious, you can call us and we can discuss this, or you can go to our discussion board at wittybanner.com.
Absolutely. And guess what? You have to link to all of them.
You got to link to all of them.
Now people wonder why we laugh at the British.
Hyperlinks allow people to surf from one web page to another by clicking on highlighted text. At a one-day hearing in federal court in White Plains, New York on Monday, BT will seek to show that a patent filed in 1976, well before the rise of the Internet to mainstream, applies to the standard of hyperlinks today. If BT were to win the suit, there could be an enormous damages against Prodigy and other ISPs, which are Internet service providers, which could be liable for 6 years of prior use of hyperlinking. Web developers and computer scientists outraged by BT's suit point to a 1968 footage of a Stanford Research Institute computer scientist demonstrating the first computer mouse and technology he called hyperlinks.
Great. So, not only are the British being laughed at, now they're even wrong. Somebody had it before them, and guess who? It was the Americans. Stanford. What a surprise. American ingenuity. Figured it out. Got the hyperlinks. And now the British are trying to sue us for our own technology. Go figure.
Not only was it a was it an American? It was a Pac-10 school, right?
Absolutely.
Go Pac-10. All right. Snoopware, new technologies, laws threaten privacy. The FBI's, quote-unquote, magic lantern, keystroke logger, could help catch terrorists, but at what cost to your fundamental rights?
I like that. Anything nowadays can help catch terrorists. I mean, they could throw us all in jail, and guess what?
That would prevent terrorism.
Hey,
all right. Last November, the FBI acknowledged, okay, this is not real. This is really real. They acknowledged the existence of Magic Lantern, a Trojan horse program, and it is developed that will render encryption useless on a suspect's computer by logging the user's keystrokes. Coupled with a law that Congress passed following the September 11th attacks, I suppose, Magic Lantern will give the agency unprecedented access to digital communications. So the FBI has created what they call a Trojan horse. And according to Norton Utilities and many other places, most Trojan horses, such as back orifice, are known as viruses.
Exactly. They've created a virus to distribute to computers to, quote-unquote, help prevent terrorism. Even though it was developed before terrorism, even though it was in use, although not acknowledged, before the terrorist attacks, now all of a sudden it's to help prevent terrorism. Go figure.
Well, here's the thing, is that it's a Trojan horse, therefore it's put in on the back end of another program. My question is, what is that other program it's on the back end of?
I don't know. Could be anything. That's the great thing about viruses, you know. You can put them in on anything. They could attach it to an email, a spam, junk mail, send it to you. You open the mail. It has a code in there. It loads it to your computer without you ever knowing it. And now the FBI can track your every movement on your computer. And why? Well, because they jumped on the terrorism bandwidth. And, of course, they're invading your privacy and taking away your freedom and liberties to help combat terrorism. terrorism.
But if you have nothing to hide, what's the problem?
Well, you know, it's just like we said when we were discussing national ID cards. When anybody asks you, what do you have to hide? I mean, if you have nothing to hide, then why do you care? The question to ask them, to quote Scooter, is, why do you need to know that kind of information about me? Why is it so important? What are you planning on doing to me that you need to know that kind of information about me?
Exactly. What do you plan on doing to me? Why do I have to give you that information? Don't turn it and put it in my face and say, why are you afraid of showing it to me? It should be up to you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Constitution is on our side. The Bill of Rights say that we have the right to not have the government interfere in our lives and take away our very freedom and liberties, that say that the government does not have total control over every aspect of our life. That's what the Bill of Rights is all about. That's what the Constitution is all about. And yet somehow the government is trying to twist this that we have to provide evidence to them that we're innocent. That's not the way the legal system works, folks. It's innocent until proven guilty, not guilty until you prove yourself innocent.
And in one last final article for the day.
Well, hang on.
Okay.
I was going to say, the FBI has been doing stuff like this for ages. Don't they have supposedly, I don't know if they've admitted to it yet, don't they have a carnivore program that reads all the emails that are on a person's computer?
Yes. As a matter of fact, that is also mentioned in this article that you can get to by going to our website at www.informationtechnologyprofessionals.com/PES. Coach Rob Akey, just shut up. I'm all excited.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, we're going to go to a song right now, and we're
going to
get them on the air as soon as we can, so stay tuned.
You're listening to the Peter Eichmann Show on 90.7 FM KZUU.
In the studio, we have Coach Rob Akey from the WSU football team. Hey, Rob.
How y'all doing this morning?
We're doing great now that you're here. Trust me on that one. We're doing great now that you're here. What we're going to talk about today is WSU football, and we're going to talk to Coach Rob Akey about it. We're also going to take phone calls. If anybody wants to talk to Coach Rob Akey, our phone number is 335-2207, and I'd like to talk about a little bit about Rob Akey's past. He came to WSU in 1998 at the age of 32. He's now 35. He coached at Weber State and Northern Arizona. He replaces Larry Lewis, who left to go to Idaho, I believe, as a head coach.
Idaho State.
Okay. He spent 4 years at Northern Arizona, including 3 years as a defensive coordinator. And prior to that, he was 6 years as an assistant coach at his alma mater, Weber State, and I believe you were underneath Price as a player there?
Yeah, I played for Coach Price. It's actually Weber State. Played for Coach Price
Weber
there,
State?
And
okay.
And then spent 1 year as a graduate assistant, Coach Price's last year there. And then when the change took place, when he came up here to Washington State, I ended up staying there, became a full-time coach at 21 years old, and started my coaching career there.
Very good. He, and like he said, he was coaching the Wildcats as a defensive line coach.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Here's a little quote from Mike Price. Rob will coach the defensive line along with Mike Walker. Rob is a great motivator and will bring excitement to our program. An article that appeared in the Seattle Times on November 14th says, this is also another quote that happens to be by Mike Price. It says, They were at the end of their second 18-hour shift in 2 days, and they were jumping around. Talk about enthusiasm and emotion. And that's what actually Peter and I saw Coach Price on the sidelines, one of our first games that we went to. Normally we sat around the 50-yard line, and this particular game we got there a little late, so we sat down sort of right around the 35, 40-yard line, sort of behind the defense. And there's this coach out there, young-looking guy, gray hair. And he's like a fan. It's like I was down there on the field because he's jumping up and down, he's screaming and yelling. And one thing he said we can't really repeat on the radio, but it was just like we're just laughing our rear ends off. I mean, we had a great time, and we sit up there in the stands, and when Coach Aikie talks, we listen and then cheer afterwards because he's a great motivator. And we decided then that we wanted to get a show here on KZUU, and we decided then that he was going to definitely be one of our guests if we could get him.
Absolutely. That was like the best late game that we had ever gone to. It changed our lives. We started sitting behind this guy always, and it was at one time, at one point in every game, he would say something, and then the entire line of fans, about 30 fans, would just yell it and chant it exactly what he says, which we can't really repeat. And we're just jumping up and down, back and forth. Great.
Oh, we could repeat some of it, I'm sure. But and then the very last game, we got together and we made this little sign. It said, "A key to winning is defense," spelled A-K-E-Y, of course. And when we were putting the sign together, it was like a whole bunch of sheets of paper that had each letter on it. And we were putting it together and trying to get it all perfect and everything before the game. And it actually spelled out, a key to defense is winning. And we're like, oh, this is all wrong. So we're like tearing the sign apart and re-putting it back together and everything. But it would have been quite embarrassing if we had actually made it to the field with a paper that looked like that. Also, Coach Rob Aikie played for Price, as we already talked about, in 1988. He was a 1988 Wildcat graduate. And amongst the team's top defensive players. In 87, the team finished 10-3, earned its first ever NC2A playoff bid. Aikie made 67 tackles, 2 sacks, and recovered 2 fumbles, earning all Big Sky Conference first team honors and honorable mention All-American recognition. And during his play, he saw action as a defensive tackle, a linebacker, and end. Mike Price said, Coach Aikie said, when making the decision to move to Pullman from Northern Arizona, his response was Mike Price. And I was just curious if you could expand on that a little bit.
Oh, yeah. It was, people said, well, you're the defense coordinator down there. Why you want to come up here and be a position coach? And Mike Price is the ultimate reason. There's no question about it. I had the opportunity to play for him, and it was a great experience. He's the reason that I am coaching football. He made it fun for the players. Everything that was done within the program was done with the players' best interest in mind. And it was demanding and all those things, but it could still be fun, and it was meant to be a game. And he treats people right, and I respected that and loved that. So the opportunity to come back and get to work for Coach Price again was that was ultimate. It was awesome. And then you cap it off with being able to do it in the Pac-10. And you don't have to live in a Pac-10 city. You get to live in this is beautiful here. And I've got family and 2 little boys that I'm raising. So I couldn't be in a better spot or work for a better guy. So it's we're fired up.
It's going to be great. We got football season just a couple months away, the way I see it. And obviously, when does spring training start?
April 2nd will be the first practice. That's the spring season starts. And right now, the guys are working out. They're lifting in the weight room 4 days a week, and they're running another 2 days a week on Mondays and Thursdays. And we've got a circuit that they go through and some individual drills that they go through. And I tell you what, they're working extremely hard right now, and that's really what's got me fired up, because that was the difference. Excuse me. When you look at what happened last year, we came off the end of that season. It was very, very disappointing, and a lot of people took that very hard, and our players understood that. And they went to work. They went to work right away, and what they did during the winter months and during spring football and during the summer months, we really believe made the biggest difference in everything, what happened with this season. And, you know, when you have a season like this, it's easy for two things to take place. Guys can look back and say, oh, shoot, that was easy. And we're going to be back here and we're going to do this again. That's where you see teams that have that real good year and maybe they don't get it done the next year. That's one of the reasons it might happen to a team. These guys are fired up. They're in there working, and they went to work right away. And so we're excited about that. They understand, I think, what got them to the Sun Bowl and the top 10 this year. And that was great, but that's not good enough. They want to top that, and that's the important thing. So we've got very high expectations, and we're going to push that as hard as we can. And as long as, you know, we can keep our players healthy during the season, and we can get them all to the season, you know, with academics and whatnot. If that all takes care of itself, then we think we're going to have a lot of fun next year.
This is, once again, I'm looking forward to this coming season. I've always been looking forward to Cougar football season since my freshman year. That was sort of like what got me through the first part of my freshman year being here in Pullman. I'm like, you know, what's there to do? And Cougar football came up, and I'll tell you, Saturdays when we were out of town were dregs, and Saturdays when we were in town, that was just the greatest. We have one last little thing. He has two sons.
Yeah, two little boys.
One named Jack and one named Daniel.
Yeah.
And I have this little quote in the newspaper I thought was sort of interesting. I'll read it to you and see what you say about it.
Okay.
Okay. It's from the Tacoma News Tribune from an article from 2000. It says, Wonder why WSU hasn't been able to shake its party image despite recently declaring itself a dry campus. Well, here's one example. Assistant football coach Rob Akey has new two sons named Jack and Daniels.
Well, I didn't know that got printed. I guess their grandpas are going to be real upset about that. You know, all we did was name them after their grandfathers.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with that at all.
It was my wife's idea.
I just thought that was sort of funny because it's like, you know, this guy's trying to point something out like that, and I just wanted to know what you had to say about that.
That is pretty good.
So they're two grandpas, they're Jack and Daniel, huh?
No, not really.
It's a good story, it's a good story though.
Jack was actually named after his two grandfathers. Daniel just kind of fit.
Okay. Works for me. Okay. What we want to go into is a little bit about the 2000 campaign. Most people will remember that there were three tough overtime losses that season. And I remember one of them was just this humongous scoring affair. I think we traded touchdowns three times before we finally ended up on the short end of the stick.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was one of those seasons where three losses in overtime, if they had been turned into wins, would have made us having a winning season versus a losing season. And you know, I mean, then obviously in 2001, we had just an explosive year. You know, what were the adjustments that were made between 2000 and 2001 that made such a big difference?
Well, I think the biggest thing is keeping things in perspective, you know, because we hadn't had a lot of success the season before. And then, you know, the fact of the matter was we didn't win those overtime games, you know, and we needed to talk to our players about that. But, you know, you say that outside the community, well, then it sounds like, well, you're making excuses and that kind of thing. And we weren't trying to make excuses. We're trying to point out to our guys, hey, we're three plays away. And, I mean, three plays keep you from going to any of those overtimes, or three plays win each one of those overtimes for you. And if that's the case, you're 7-4. I mean, at worst, we come back from an Aloha Bowl or something like that, and everybody is excited as can be about the program. You know, you had the Rose Bowl a down year or two, and then, boom, there you are in another bowl game, and everything is fired up about the future. With the same football team, everybody doing the same things, with the exception of the outcome of three plays being different. You know, whether it's a tackled guy or a pass that's caught or a kick that's made, it doesn't matter. It could be any of the players that played in any of those games. The outcome of one play being different. Nobody else changes anything in the course of the season. And that's the same football team, the same guys that we're going to coach, the same guys that are going to play. But yet we're supposed to be down on them and kicking them in the tail because, well, we were 4-7 instead of 7-4. And that, I'm just talking about the three overtime games. You don't talk about the, you know, other ones that maybe you were supposed to have won. Yeah. And don't bring that up. We don't even talk about that. But anyways, that was our point with the players. I mean, we're that close to being able to make to have made that happen. Well, the fact of the matter was we didn't, and there's a reason why. So let's go to work on it. And that was the attitude, I think, that the players took into the winter last year. And, you know, and then you come out and they've worked their tails off, and spring ball we thought went great. The entire football team stayed here in Pullman last summer and worked their tails off every single day. I mean, they were committed to the thing. You know, and they obviously get real fired up when the magazines start coming out, and you know they read about themselves, they read about the picks, and when you're picked to finish 11th in the Pac-10, you know I think UCLA's JV was supposed to be in front of us. You know, there's a little more fuel on the fire, and those were things that we talked with them about at the beginning of the season, because you know we can't listen to the outside, and you know we needed to keep our goals in mind and our beliefs in mind, and that's what I think our players did, And that built over the course of this season. So, you know, that was one thing that I think that made as big a difference as anything. Now you look at the reality part of the situation as well. You go back to that 2000 season, there were a lot of players that we dealt with injuries, a great deal of injuries. There were players that were supposed to be playing that, you know, were ineligible and didn't get the opportunity to play. Now we survived that this year. We didn't the year before. The other guys that were out there, you know, I think one of the things that really came along for us this season, you look at the two fronts, our offensive and defensive fronts, those same guys were playing last year, but they were rookies, you know, and you're going to go in the Pac-10 with freshmen playing in those key roles when they're, you know, they're not as strong as they're going to be yet, and they're not as big as they're going to be yet, and I think that has a big impact on the type of success you're going to have, and you know, so our players grew up. And we still had injuries this year, but we were able to overcome them. And now all those young guys, they're still young. I mean, there's a lot of sophomores played on this football team that were difference makers on this football team. You know, a little bit, I think, is a payday from, you know, them kind of learning on the fly when they were freshmen. And it was painful, you know, for them as it was for us and the fans. But hopefully we're being rewarded a little bit for that now, and those players are. And I'm excited about what I think those guys are going to be able to do. You know, and the thing that really had me fired up about it was the fact that we did have those overtime losses. You look at the way the football team continued to play. You go lose a triple overtime game down at Arizona, and, I mean, you if you just take a look at the country and most of the teams that play overtime games, there is a significant difference in the way they play the following week, whether they won or lost the dang thing. Now, if they lost that overtime game, chances are they're not going to be as – it affects the way they play anyways. We'll say that the next week. Well, that was a triple overtime game. Guys come back and we battled their tails off again. And we had it with Arizona. We had it with Oregon. We had it with Arizona State. And what was the – Oregon game, I think, was the last one, or the Arizona State one. It doesn't matter, but Oregon State was wedged in between those, and we didn't play well. We got we got whacked over there. But they came back, and we had another overtime. It was Oregon. Oregon's like ninth in the country, and we come and battle and had the opportunity to win that game after two overtime losses and after, you know, not playing well and what we felt like was being embarrassed. But still able to come and battle and play our tails off and then go down to the Coliseum and beat USC with the backup quarterback, you know, and he came in and did a great job, and the players did a great job. And, you know, you're not supposed to beat USC. We're never supposed to beat USC, but you're certainly not supposed to do it in the Coliseum in Los Angeles. And those kids went down and did that. So, you know, there's something there when you can overcome those games and yet still come and play the way that they did, and that was what we wanted to carry into the off season. To, you know, take the positive things. We don't have to worry about the negative stuff. All you got to do is pick up the newspaper or walk you out in town, and they'll tell you how bad everything is. But if you can keep sight of what the good things are, and that, then that was that made the difference for us. And then that nice big old weight room over there, that helped too, because that got us, got us in the condition that we needed to be in, the shape and the strength. And honestly, that's something that still needs to improve and is being improved at this point in time.
Right. They talked a little bit about Drew Dunning, which I know you don't probably deal with Drew Dunning.
Sure. But we're all Cougars, man.
Yeah, you're all Cougs. But they talked about how his kicking, his leg, got a lot more strength between last year, 2000, in the 2001 season, where his leg just, increased in strength. And I suppose that's just one indication of how the extra strength makes a big difference in your whole performance as a player.
Yeah, that right there proves that it happens for every player on the field. You know, and you know, I don't know how much difference the strength made in Drew, but he certainly did a great job for us this year. And he battled to do a great job that the year before, and had some tough situations that, you know, that he had to deal with, as we all did. You know, but there's no question when you're able to add the experience and the maturity level, and then strength and starting to mature a little bit, that's going to help you a ton.
Okay, so last year, 2001, great season, lots of great plays. What are your most memorable plays from last season?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know if it's so much plays as it is games, you know. I think the Stanford win was a turning point for us in the season. And I won't say turning point, but I think that was a little bit of a launching pad, maybe is a better way of putting that, because we'd gone down there and things had gone very well. We hadn't played a close game yet. We'd whacked everybody that we played, and usually it was early and then just finished the game. It was a lot of fun, and then being able to set the tempo in those games was awesome. And then, you go down there in Stanford, and they're another good football team, and, you're talking about two of the better teams in the Pac-10, obviously, and that battle that took place that day kind of kept going back and forth. And then, and we're doing it with, we had starters that weren't able to play. Minnick was injured, and then his backup comes in and got injured, and Tippins came in and did a fantastic job for us. And Randall Smith wasn't able to play. And then, Saren comes in and he gets injured. And we've got our man Bingo, Ira Davis, comes in. And, he'd been a safety just a few weeks before, and he's playing linebacker for us now. And he ends up with two sacks and an interception. We got guys that were, not the starters, coming in, making significant plays that made the difference in the ball game. And that right there was absolutely huge, and the fact that we won a close game at somebody else's place. And, you looked at those two football teams, we were better conditioned than them. We were in better shape. It was a hot day in Palo Alto that afternoon, and our players handled it better than theirs did. And we were able to fix some things in the second half that were hurting us in the first half. And guys made big plays. I mean, Bush's catch for the touchdown at the end of the game was awesome. Billy Newman picking up the deal, the quarterback signaling, intercepting the ball and taking that thing to the hut. That was huge. And not to mention however many other plays took place. Didi Atchilano sacks the quarterback four times on that day. And then the pass rush on their last series when they were trying to make something happen to come down the field, it was a great day. And that I think helped us know that, hey, we're at a level that we can do something great with. And I think the players saw that it was a launching pad. Hey, we won the close game, so now that was an expectancy. Now, the press and all that, they're still waiting to say, I told you so, and they're all mad about that because they had to wait another week. Oh, okay, got this one. And then they had to admit that Stanford was a good football team. So, I thought that was a good thing, too. And, and so you look at that and, as a defense, the UCLA game, well, not as a defense, as a football team, the UCLA game was awesome in that, and that in a lot of respects. And I say defense because the week before we'd embarrassed ourselves, we felt we went from being the number one run defense in the conference and number seven in the country to we can't tackle Ontario Smith, and that was very embarrassing. The only thing that was positive was it wasn't a lot of points, but we weren't getting the ball back for the offense, and that's why God made defense. That's what we're here for, and we didn't get that done on that day, so that was real embarrassing. I mean, I come walking in the door after the game, and Jack walks up to me when I come in the house, and that was the only thing that saved me that day, because they were fired up. Daddy was still home. I'm still Daddy when I came in the door. But he said, Daddy, you guys need to break number two's leg. Told him that would have helped. I wish he could have gone out there and done it that day. So that was embarrassing for us. Now, our football team still battled back, and we had an opportunity to win that thing at the end. So then everybody got their chance to say, hey, told you so. Cougs couldn't do it. Well, here comes UCLA. And now all of a sudden we weren't supposed to – our people – our media and fans didn't think, hey, you're going to get that done. Not all our fans. I won't say that. That's not true. But there was still the side, I think, that wanted to see us maybe not get it accomplished. And that was absolutely awesome. And I can't say the fans, because the fans were awesome. The Duck game and the UCLA game, those crowds were awesome. And I'm telling you, that made a difference. That helped us get the job done on those days. But get back to what I started talking about, you know, when our defense screwed up the week before and we were able to fix that, because UCLA's got a lot better running game than what Oregon did. You know, Deshaun Foster was as good as there was in the league, and he hadn't got caught yet, so he was still playing that day. And, you know, and be able to hold their offense to, was it 70 yards or 60 yards rushing? We felt like that was a very positive thing. And, you know, and for our team to play the way we did, and that was a big ball game for everybody involved. And that there was a lot on the line that day. And our football team came up and did a great job. And then took it on the road at Arizona State, and that was, you know, that was a fun one. And then the Sun Bowl, you know, you certainly remember that. That was a great experience. The people down there were awesome. It was a great football game for the fans to watch. It was fun for us too. We made it a little more exciting than we'd like to have made it, but that was in the contract. You guys gotta know that. Every time we started running away with it, we were supposed to let them back into the game. CBS made us do that. Yeah, they made us do that. And you know, so those are some of the things I think you look back on and think, hey, that was awesome. You know.
Totally.
Definitely.
One thing that was sort of interesting, you know, you have the Mariners who, you know, played one of the best baseball seasons in the history of baseball.
Oh, yeah, big time.
You know, and as a Seattle Mariner fan, you get to this expectation that when the Mariners are on the field, they're going to win, period. You know, if they lose, it's like a shocker. And, you know, 1997, Cougar football, you know, it was an expectation that they were going to win each and every game. And 2001 was the same exact expectation. From me, from Peter,
we
were like, you know, we're going to go out. The Cougars are going to win the game. Granted, it was one of those things that I have two sides. It's like one side of me wants it to be a blowout, so there's no stress, no worry about it at all.
I like that side of you.
the other side, I sort of like that adversity where it's like coming down to the last plays where where the whole entire game, the whole fan base could just really be in it, really be jumping up and down, and you know that Oregon game when we did finally get the ball back and we marched down to about the 8-yard line and made a couple of those plays to Mike Bush. You know, that last one, I thought he had caught the ball because where I was sitting was, you know, obviously behind you. We always get the front row
same
there.
Thing. Yeah.
And it came down. I thought he caught it. We're jumping up and down, screaming and yelling, you know, get high fives, the whole works. And then all of a sudden, somebody behind us is like, he dropped it. I'm like, what? And I was just so shocked. And I mean, that was like, I mean, you go from the highest of high to the lowest of low in a heartbeat. And I mean, I guess that's one thing I like about sports. You know, it just gives you that natural adrenaline.
For the record, I like the close games where the Cougs are only up by, say, 2 touchdowns, you know. Those are the kind of games I like.
That's close enough, isn't it?
Yeah.
But, you know, you're right. We kind of feel the same way. It's fun when you go out and you can just get after it and stomp somebody and that's a great time, and you know, we had a lot of fun in the games that we were able to do that. But you know, there's when you're playing somebody that's at the same level as you, you know, the better teams, it is a lot of fun. And, you know, and we're talking to our guys on the sideline about that. I mean, that's why you do this. I mean, when you're coming down to it, and it's the fourth quarter, and the game's on the line, and you know, and our attitude is, hey, we're gonna go out there and win it on defense, and you know, our offensive guys' attitude, hey, we're gonna go out there and we're gonna get the job done. I mean, that's the mindset you got to have. But if that's the case, I mean, that is why you do this. And you remember those games, and it's awesome experience.
Yeah, you know, Peter and I talk about, you know, who won what game, you know, offense defense type thing, you know, and obviously it's not just one side; both sides have to play equally well or relatively well.
Always the case.
But there's those situations where, you know, you can look back and say, you know, defense was, or the offense did not have it going today, and if it wasn't for the defense, that game would have been a loss, that kind of thing. And I think, I don't know if you know much about the 1994 Palouse Posse, the defense we had that
year. They were awesome.
They were awesome. And we had, I would say, most of the games, if it wasn't for the defense, we probably would have never seen a bowl game that year. And I was just sort of curious if what kind of comparisons you might be able to make between that team and the 2001 team.
Well, I think the talent level on the offenses was this offense that we had this year was obviously a lot better than what that one was. You know, and I wasn't here then. I was close to the program, you know, and paid a lot of attention to it, and certainly paid a lot of attention to the defense. And in fact, had a couple game tapes from that year when I was coaching linebackers at NAU. I said, this is the way you play linebacker, because that was an awesome crew. That defense, you know, most of those guys went on and kept playing football after they got done here. So, you know, that says a lot about where they were at. And to be number one in the country, that's a powerful statement, because it's hard to do if you're playing the little sisters of the poor, to, you know, keep points off the board and even keep yards from taking place. I mean, people are going to make plays. So that, you know, that was awesome about them. And I'd leave it to that, because that's about all I know about that team. I wasn't around that team. I know that this team had talent on both sides of the ball, and we did it with both experienced talent and young talent. The thing that I'm fired up about is there's a lot of returning talent. I think has got to be more of a complete football team than what that one was, because there was, you know, our offense led the country in damn near everything for the first half of the season, and stayed, obviously, you know, one of the top offenses in the country as you look back on it now. And our defense was able to do the same thing. And actually, you know, their rankings were higher than our defense was. And that's, you know, we want to be not only the best in the Pac-10, but we want to be the best in the country as a defense. And that's something that we're trying to, you know, we want to work towards being able to accomplish. And I think that's realistic.
I believe so. I mean, we have a article from collegefootballnews.com, and it's titled "Debate Number 2: Oregon or Wazoo, Who Will Challenge Washington for the Pac-10?" And so I guess it's a foregone conclusion that the Huskies are going to be number one of the Pac-10, and I don't agree with that already. But they're saying that it's either going to be Oregon or Wazoo, Washington State, that's going to be the number one or number two team in the Pac-10. And one quote from here says, "Most losses for the Cougs came from the defensive side. The safeties Lamont Thompson and Billy Newman will not be able to pilot the Wazoo's defensive backfield in a generally pass-happy conference. The Cougars have also lost a lot of bodies at the linebacker position, meaning that several underclassmen will be called upon to learn and learn quickly. It can be said that WSU's defense is in search of a body, let alone a head. Whereas the Ducks have inexperience at quarterback, the Cougars will be inexperienced up and down their defensive roster." Tear that apart for me, Coach.
Well, that's good. I'm glad they're looking at us that way, because obviously, we feel differently about our defense. Pretty fired up about our defense, and I think that there's no question you're going to miss those seniors. And you know, Lamont Thompson's an All-American. You're going to miss that. He's set the Pac-10 record for interceptions and the Washington State record for interceptions. You can't help but miss that. But that's why they have seniors and they have freshmen and sophomores and juniors. You know, when your time comes and it goes, and somebody else fills in your place. And those records are all made to be broken. And Lamont was able to do that. And we're going to miss Lamont, because Lamont was awesome. He was a great player and a great free safety. He had great range and was able to make plays on the ball. You can't say enough good things about Lamont Thompson. And that's why he's going to get drafted very high and get paid a lot of money to get to play this game. And it's awesome. You're going to miss that in Lamont. We're going to miss Billy Newman's leadership. You know, he's done some fantastic things for us as a leader and helped, you know, pull the level I think that we were looking for up. You're going to miss those two guys. But, you know, there were also some kids that did play those positions last year and helped us get the job done. Eric Coleman is going to be able to play safety. You know, Eric started and was in and played all season long for us and played both at corner and at safety. You know, he's probably going to be one of the safeties this year. And, you know, there's a guy you put the first pass of the Oregon State game on, and you watch Eric Coleman run that interception in for a touchdown and set the tempo for that day. So, you know, you're bringing that guy in. And then, you know, we've got a couple youngsters that, you know, played nickel and dime, you know, some backup type roles for us during the course of this season that might be a little more athletic, might be a little faster. And those are guys that are going to be competing this spring to have the opportunity to play one of those safety positions. The corners are both coming back, and we've got some backups that are able to fill into those roles. Guys that, you know, we're grooming in the system. So, you know, obviously they're unproven, and nobody else has seen them yet. It's not like the cupboard, I don't think, is bare there. I think we've got some very talented guys. I think that's a good thing. At linebacker, you know, you'll miss Randall Smith. He's a freak of nature, a big guy that can run and hit like he can, and he's going to get to play on Sundays. And so are you going to miss that? Sure, you're going to miss that. You know, you got to remember Al Janatone's coming back. And Pat Bennett learned on the fly as a freshman this year. And Will Durding would have done the same thing had he not gotten that knee hurt, in the Idaho game early in the season. He was talented enough to have played this year as well. And, those are just a couple of names. Plus, you had the two junior college linebackers that we're bringing in the mix, and that helps with the depth at that position. So, and the high school kids, too. We think we're going to be all right at that linebacker. And maybe as a whole, maybe you don't have the standout guys, but maybe the unit might be a little bit better, if you know what I'm saying there. And and in the defensive line, certainly we're going to miss Tupou and what Nate Mallory brought to us. Tupou started all season long for us and did a fantastic job. Was a great Cougar. Nate Mallory, a tough son of a gun, and came in and, he helped us win and helped us do things. They weren't the guys that played every snap and all the time. All those other guys are coming back. And we're going to miss them, yes, but the front is all back. And that front's going to be back with the exception of Fred Chavies for another year after that. So, we're pretty excited about that. And the number one sack leader in the Pac-10 is coming back. And the number three pass rush sack leader in the Pac-10 is coming back. And all those defensive tackles are coming back. All four of those guys played for us, played a great role for us this year. And they're all going to be back. And, so that's going to help us tremendously. And if the secondary is still getting themselves going because they're young, well, then we need to put a little more pressure on the defensive line. The best coverage is pass rush. Right?
Yes. Get the Cougars out there. We're going to take a quick break, go with a song. We'll be back with Coach Akey, and we'll spend a couple minutes with the WSU Intramural Sports Update. You're listening to KZUU 90.7 FM, and on the phone with me, I have Tyler from the Intramural Sports. I used to have Tyler with me. Let me go the other way. Tyler, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
All right. Okay, Tyler with Intramural Sports is going to talk, give us a quick update, and then we'll be back with Coach Rob Akey to finish out the hour.
All right, for Intramural Sports, basketball is still going strong. We're in our third week. Wiffle ball is in our second week. We just finished up a weekend full of shuffleboard and indoor tennis tournament. And bowling should start pretty soon here. It just ended on February 10th. Any information is still available on our website at cub.wsu.edu/im.
Thank you very much. And once again, that number can be... website can be located on our website at informationtechnologyprofessionals.com/PES. Did you have anything else, Tyler?
No, that's it.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Goodbye. Okay. We have, once again, Coach Akey with the WSU football team, who will be coming back on the air momentarily to talk about Cougar football. Okay, Coach Akey.
Yes, sir.
We were talking a little bit about the article number two in the Pac-10, Oregon versus WSU, who's going to be the second place team. Because as we already know, I guess the Huskies are going to be in first place. But I think the defense and offense of the Cougars will have something to say about that throughout the season. What do you see as the outlook for the 2002 season? We have a pretty full schedule of games, and I think we have, 13 games this year?
Yeah, we have 13 games scheduled to play before we go to our bowl game. And it's going to be, so it'll be a long season. That's two additional regular season games, and then we're going to start the season August 31st, and then the last game of the regular season is going to get played, the weekend following Thanksgiving. And then obviously our goal is to finish the season on January 1st, and that's what we're looking to get accomplished. But we like the way the schedule is set up. We got a couple games that I think are good. They're supposed to be tune-up type games, and then you've got the Ohio State game, which should be playing somebody outside the conference that's like you are, and then the Pac-10, and the Pac-10 is going to be. It's going to be an awesome league next year. I think everybody, I don't know if anybody's going to be down next year. So You know, that's going to be a challenge, and we're fired up about it, though. We're excited. You know, we'll play everywhere from here to Hawaii, and we get the Apple Cup at our place this year, and that's a big thing for us. I really like the way the schedule is set up, and we're excited about it. So that's what we're going to work on, you know, right now. And, you know, how they're going to pick all that stuff. They're going to pick Washington, and they're going to pick Oregon, and we'll let them pick it. The only one that really matters is when you get to the end of the deal, and our goal will be hopefully to maybe try to answer that for everybody if we can, and that's what we want to get done.
Yeah, I suppose if we never got on the field and played the game and we always went with what they picked, I guess we'd always be 10th in the Pac-10, right?
They do call it a game for a reason.
Exactly. Okay, we just finished up a recruiting time, and we have picked up a batch of new guys.
Yes, we have.
And I'd like to speak about some of the guys that you expect us to see maybe in this coming 2002 season, some of the defensive guys.
Okay, well, certainly, you know, the two linebackers, we brought them in to help us with depth and competition at those at the linebacker positions. So, you know, and we've got one of them on campus right now. That's Kevin Sperry, who came to us from L.A. Harbor College. And then the other one is from Grossmont College down in San Diego, and that's Donnie Jackson. He'll be here in August, you bring those guys in to push. We think we've got talent at that position. If we didn't bring a guy in, you know, we've got good linebackers. Our guy's coming back, but I think we need more of them. And this helped us to fix that. And competition is always your best tool. So we'll find out where that sits. And those guys are certainly the ones on defense you're going to expect to see in the mix right now. That's why you go get junior college players. And then the three junior college running backs that we signed, you expect to see them in the mix and making something happen. And those are three of the best ones in the country. It's a feat in itself to be able to sign that many junior college running backs, because when you run a single back offense and they, you know, you can't, the internet tells them more than what we know a lot of times. And, you know, they're thinking, well, you know, why am I going to go there? And then, you know, parents get involved in those types of things. But, they all want to be here and make something happen. They're all going to have the opportunity to make something happen. So we're excited about what that brings to the table. And then the high school guys, you know, there's going to be maybe a couple of them that you'll see on the field right away. And then there's going to be a lot of them that, you know, you don't want to put that pressure on youngsters if you don't need to. If they're talented enough, they're able to go out and play. So then you're talking about probably the skilled kids, because you're either faster or you're not, you know, and you can get out there and play. Now, experience is still going to have something to do with that. And strength is still going to have something to do with that you don't gain until you start to get to become an older player. But there are going to be some young players that will have that opportunity. The linemen, you know, those linemen better be planning on redshirting and coming in down lines. If you're playing true freshmen in your lines, there are not a lot of them that are ready to come in and compete at that level, at this level in the fronts, you know, because size and strength is the big deal there. So, but I tell you what, I'm real excited about what those guys can do. And I'm not telling you that there's not a guy or two in that mix that couldn't make a difference. Adam Braidwood is a defensive end from Canada that could find himself in the mix this year. The kid is he's a stud. He was in our football camp this past summer, and that's actually when he chose to come to Washington State. And he stayed strong throughout the deal. And like we got three or four guys out of that football camp elected to come with us. These guys were awesome. They were talking to each other during the course of the season. When they did come in for the visit, I remember one night we got done with the dinner, and they're fixing to go out and you know, meet some of the people in town and some of the other players. And you know, I remember saying, "Hey, have a good time tonight." And they said, "Coach, there's four guys that haven't committed in this room right now. We're not having fun tonight. We're working. They wanted these guys to come and play with them." So, you know, they're diehards. They're ready to be here. So I think Adam is a guy that's got an opportunity to make something happen. And everybody here is going to love him. He's what a Cougar ought to be. He's got a great motor. He's a tough son of a gun. I mean, he takes his teeth out to come to practice. And he's going to be a good player. We're excited about him. And then there's also the other junior college player, and, you know, the punt returner, receiver, Sammy Moore, that was a battle right down to the finish wire. And you know, you can expect to see him come in and maybe make something happen right away next year. And then, you know, the other kids, I think, you know, if you look through the list, there's, you know, what we're excited about, there's a lot of Washington kids that are on this list, and that's a great thing to us. There are a lot of guys that we've got on this, on our signing list this year that you know, we battled like a son of a gun to get in years past, and maybe they didn't come. But there's a lot of them we told no to this year that they can certainly be good players here, and we just weren't able to recruit them. So we think we did well, and obviously we're going to expect that it's a good class. We wouldn't have recruited them. So I had a guy ask me, he was asking me about down on one of the players he'd seen on our list. Well, you know, is he a good player? Because, you know, he's really not very good. He's slow, and he's small, and he's weak, too. But we thought we'd give him a scholarship. You know, yeah, we're excited about it. And everybody's critical. They say, well, you know, everybody says, well, this is the best class you ever had. Well, we do think it's good. And, you know, time will tell if it's a good class or not. You know, everybody was a smart mouth about it a few years back. And it turns out that class that brought in Jeremy Williams and Ryan Long and Fafatai Tupai and Josh Parrish and those guys, that ended up being a pretty good class. So time will tell. You know, we're never going to get – our recruiting class is never going to get ranked one of the tops in the country. And we don't need it to be. We want our football team to be. And right now we're 10th in the country, and we want to top that. And that's why these players have elected to come and join us. One of the reasons these players have come to join us. And that's what we want to build on right now.
Right. We one of the things I was reading is about the Huskies, pretty much with in-state players, recruiting-wise. The story is that the Huskies, I mean, if they want somebody, the person pretty much is going to go there. That, you know, more or less, if the Huskies want them, they're going to get them, is the consensus that was in the story. But I was curious, you've been recruiting now, I suppose, since you got here at WSU.
Right.
And what I've been reading is that you're a pretty popular guy in the recruiting circles, that guys like being recruited by you. What is your feeling on guys from Washington, from the state of Washington, who play high school ball around here? Are they all hot to trot on the Huskies, or are they ready to go wherever they're going to get a good deal, a good education, a good opportunity to play ball? What's a big driving force to come to WSU for a lot of guys?
Well, I think obviously you're looking for the fit. 90% of the time, you're looking. It's the best fit is what makes the deal with guys. Is there a burning desire from every guy in the state to play for the Washington Huskies? I don't think so. I certainly hope not. You know, and there's not the case. There's guys that grew up around here, and they want to be Cougars, and that's what they grew up wanting to be. And you know, those guys I want to pay attention to, because they're the guys that are going to make it here. If they're a guy that grew up wanting to be a Husky, then there's a little bit of foo-foo to them, and they want to go be in the city. And that's not what the Cougs are all about, you know. And yeah, that's Washington's attitude, and that's a lot of people's attitude. They can go get anybody in the state. And, you know, their facilities enable them to do a lot of those things. I mean, you know, they've got a lot of things that we're still working on getting built. You know, we need to get that indoor facility built. That's going to make a difference for us in recruiting, as well as helping our team to be better. Can we get guys out of the state of Washington and other places? Absolutely. Do they all grow up in Washington? I think if you went and asked Don Turner if he wanted to be a Husky, I don't think that's the case. You know, he's coming to Washington State, and Jeremy Williams and Eric Coleman and guys like that. You know, and we got 11 guys in this class that elected to be Cougars, and you know, some of them got recruited by Washington, and some of them didn't, but a guy has to want to be wherever he's going to go. And a guy has got to want to be a Cougar, to come and be a Cougar. And that's the guy you want to be here, because if a guy comes here and he is, you know, he's not sold on the place or the community or whatever the deal is, then you're not getting that whole person. You know, part of him is someplace else. And if part of him is someplace else, then he's not the best student he can be. He's not the best player he can be. He's not the best person he can be. So you're not going to get the best football player that you can get. So it's not worth having that guy here. Does that make sense what I'm saying? And we had some – there were some guys that we've got that the Huskies tried to swoop in on late, and they didn't get them. You know, and then there was a couple that they did get. And that happened to them. And you know, that's the nature of recruiting. But, you know, we deal with the same thing when you go down to California. You know, it's we go recruit players in California – a guy has got to fit us, fit our offense, fit our defense. He's got to be a tough guy to fit in this program. Pullman isn't the bright lights in the big city, and it's not nightclubs and all that kind of stuff. And that's not why you should be coming to college. You come to college to get the degree that means you got to get paid later in life, and you get to play football to pay for it. That's an awesome deal. And if those aren't priorities for you, then honestly, you don't want that guy to be here. That's what recruiting is about, finding out what those guys are all about. There's a lot of it. You go after great players and you find out, hey, the fit's not there. And so you just don't recruit them any longer. You find the guys that fit what we're looking for. So there are players that we started to recruit that we no longer did because it wasn't going to be Washington State. And that doesn't mean we got beat. It doesn't mean anything. It just means that kid wasn't going to be successful here. So why waste our time? We don't need to have a nationally ranked recruiting class. We need to have a nationally ranked football team. And so if we can get guys that we believe in that want to be here and we can coach them up, well, we got a chance to achieve our goal of winning games and being a nationally ranked team, and we get guys that they're focused on being here, then they're going to graduate, and then we can achieve our program goals, and we can graduate our players, and we can win the Pac-10, and we can win the Rose Bowl, and that's what we're trying to get done. So, the recruiting battles when, Washington, they come into Seattle, and it's a big city, and, they're on the top of the Space Needle, and they're at the Metropolitan Grill, and, when they go to Oregon, the Nike jet flies them into town, and those are the things that they experience, and, they walk into the indoor facilities at both of those places. And even Oregon State's got one of those now. And Oregon State's using private jets to fly them in and out of there. And then obviously you go to the, Arizona and Arizona State. It's the one time a year where it's a pretty nice place to live. The weather's nice, and, the girls are all pretty, and they don't tell them. If you're not from there, you don't experience the fact that from May to October, it's over 100 degrees every day. Now, for some guys, that's great. That's what they want. But that's what they see when they come to each of those places. And Nike doesn't sponsor Washington State to the level that, what they do like at Oregon. We don't have a swoosh jet that flies them in here. They come in on Horizon. But I tell you what, we wouldn't trade this place for the world, and you just find the guys that are going to fit here. And when they come here and they experience it, that's when the real truth is, because they're around our players. And our players are the ones that can convince them whether they should come here or not, because they're living what we're talking to them about every day. They expect to hear the coaches say it, and if we're honest with them and then they experience it when they come here, then that helps them with their belief with us a little bit too. And that's something that's more solid than all the bright lights and the foo-foo stuff that you can throw at recruits. We're certainly going to make it as nice as we can, and we do want to impress them, but they need to try to impress us when they come here also. And if it's a good fit, those are the guys we end up with, and then we're going to, try to coach their tails off and see how many games we can win with them.
Great. Unfortunately, our time is almost gone. I think we have about 20 more hours we'd like to spend with Coach Yakey, but unfortunately, the clock says we only have about 10 more, well, one more minute.
About a minute, yeah.
About a minute. So I guess to wrap up our day with Coach Yakey, what last things you want to say, and what do you believe the outcome of the Apple Cup's going to be, point-wise?
It's going to be 0-0 when we kick it off. I can guarantee you that. And the Cougs are going to score more than the Huskies.
Okay.
We'll get the job done for y'all. And I tell you, I want to thank you guys. You guys are absolutely awesome. That whole crew, everybody in Cougar, in Martin Stadium, it was awesome. I mean, that. I hope everybody understands that made a significant difference at the, you look at the Oregon game and the UCLA game and that's a full house and it was loud. At midnight after the UCLA game, my right ear, my open ear, it was still ringing that night from the crowd. And that's, Oregon's probably one of the toughest places to play in the Pac-10. And it's because of the crowd noise, and that's the only reason it's because of. Well, Martin Stadium, those games was the same way. And if we can have it like that all the time, then that makes people want to come here even less. And it helped us win as much as anything did. And the players and you know, we expect great things, and we hope everybody's going to want to be a part of it again next year. And we got 14 games that we can all have a great time.
Yeah, I tell you, you got two fans who will be here right behind you all next season, and we'll be cheering on the whole team, and of course, we'll
Absolutely.
Be watching everything you do.
Thanks, guys. You guys are awesome.
All right, thanks, Thank Coach you. Akey. And to everybody else, this is KZUU 90.7 FM, and you are listening to the last part of the Peter Eichmann Show, and you will be coming in with the Children of the Sun or something like that, or Children of the Corn, or
Movie.
Yeah.
There's another DJ coming in after us. Have a good day, everybody.